Hi, this is Carter Hill. I'm the medical director for Holland America, and Paul Weber has kindly asked me to host the telecast today. The subject that Dr. Robert Wheeler will be speaking on will be on infection control on cruise ships. And I'd like to also acknowledge and thank the sponsor, Johnson Diversey, for sponsoring this telecast. I've known Dr. Wheeler for almost 18 years, and he has been a long-term doc that I've worked with both in the cruise ship venue. I've actually done educational classes at sea on cruise ship medicine with Dr. Wheeler. I would consider him a close personal friend, but over the last 5 to 7 years, Bob has taken a special interest in the subject of infections at sea, specifically infections such as the norovirus and other vessel sanitation program type problems. And with this interest, he has really become an expert both within the industry and I think worldwide in the particular subject that he'll be speaking on today, which will include infection control on cruise ships with a focus on norovirus and other related infections. Bob, it's your call.
Thank you, Carter. And Paul, hang in there. Things will get better. Well, welcome, everyone. Glad that you could all make it today to this talk on infection control aboard cruise ships. What we're going to talk about today is a little bit about the background of the cruise industry, then a bit about cruise ship medicine, and then go on to sanitation programs aboard cruise ships. And then we'll talk about a few of the diseases that the cruise industry has had to deal with over the past several years. Let's go on to the next slide. The North American cruise market accounts for about 75% of the world cruise market. It continues to grow at about more than 8% each year, and that's been going on for more than 20 years. Right now, there are about 180 ships sailing. They go from everything from a small ship of less than 100 guests on board to one of the new ships, such as Freedom of the Seas, which will be carrying about 4,000 guests and over 1,500 crew members. The median age of passengers right now is about 51 years. And the ships typically sail at greater than 95% capacity, so it's a very successful industry over the past two decades. Next slide. There are more than 10 million passengers aboard cruise ships in the North American market in the year 2005 with revenues of over $10 billion. When you look at where these cruises are going from North America, 50% go to the Bahamas and the Caribbean, and another 40% go to Europe, Alaska, Mexico, the Panama Canal, Hawaii, and South America. Next slide. When people travel aboard cruise ships, they have very high expectations. They expect to see a beautiful ship, a comfortable stateroom, great food, exciting activities. And although they may not think about it before they leave their homes, when they do come up with some type of illness or injury, they expect competent medical care aboard cruise ships, and also a safe and sanitary environment. Next slide. As Dr. Hill mentioned, I've been involved in cruise ship medicine for more than 20 years now. And this is the practice of medicine aboard cruise ships designed to provide passengers and crew members with timely access to quality medical services for minor to severe illness and injury. Next slide. When people consider what cruise ship medicine is, very often they have the idea that it's essentially just seasickness and simple respiratory infections or gastric upset, but it becomes much more than that. I often tell people that the infirmary aboard a cruise ship is much more like an ambulatory care center that you may have at home with extended capabilities. It's not really a hospital. It's not really an emergency department. But we see a range of problems that can go from very minor to very severe. So you can see, in addition to the small lacerations and bumps and bruises, you'll see cardiac arrest and acute MIs and strokes, asthma, trauma, GI bleeds, acute abdomens, epidemics, sepsis, epilepsy, alcohol and other drug problems, psychiatric disorders. Next slide. And the issues come up, as I mentioned, whether this is really a hospital, which most of us aboard the ships don't consider it to be a hospital. It's more of an infirmary so that you can treat these people acutely and then, if necessary, try to get them off the ship to a shoreside facility that will have extended care facilities. We are there 24/7, 365, And sometimes it'll happen if you're on a very busy cruise and you can get very little sleep, and it's what we refer to as a hell cruise. And there's really nothing that you can do about it when you run into problems that just keep coming. But you just keep going, and you're finally very happy when your tour of duty is over at some point. Next slide. Now, on a typical one-week cruise, the medical staff will see about 1% of the total population on board each day. So if you have 3,000 people total, passengers and crew members aboard a cruise ship, you'll see typically about 30 people a day or about 200 people each week. Half of those people in the infirmary are going to be crew members, the other half are passengers. About 90% of the problems that we see are non-urgent problems, things that you could see in a walk-in center or perhaps your doctor's office at home. And these are very easily taken care of aboard ship. But then you'll have about 5% of the more urgent problems, such as people with broken bones or lacerations, and another 5% are emergent and life-threatening problems. What's interesting is that we're able to treat about 99% of all the problems that arise aboard cruise ships directly on the cruise ships. And so the number of people that actually have to be disembarked from the ship for a medical problem only accounts to about 1% of the total people that are seen in the infirmary. Next slide. This slide just gives you an idea of the types of problems that we see. It's broken down into categories by organ system of the problems aboard cruise ships as compared to U.S. emergency departments. As you can see, nearly a third of what we see have to do with respiratory problems. And typically these are the simple chest colds and head colds that people often have problems with when they're traveling. The next highest ranking category is that of minor injuries, and then you can have some problems with strokes, GI illness, cardiovascular problems, genital urinary problems, musculoskeletal problems, and so on. And although there is some difference between the two, as you can see, the different categories are very similar between what we see aboard cruise ships and in U.S. emergency departments. Next slide. Now, just a bit about cruise ship medicine as well. Cruise ship doctors and nurses are an integral part of the ship's safety, health, and hygiene team. They play a very important role in making sure that the guests and crew members remain healthy, and they're very much involved in trying to prevent any illness or injury aboard the ship. Next slide. Now, shipboard sanitation involves not only the medical department of a cruise ship, but several other departments within the industry and aboard the ships themselves. It's based upon international maritime regulations, cruise industry guidelines, corporate policies and procedures, multi-departmental shipboard protocols. Certainly the CDC vessel sanitation program is one of the big impetus to maintain a healthy environment and safe environment aboard cruise ships. And then the important function of the medical staff on board is disease surveillance and reporting. Next slide. Shipboard sanitation involves making sure that the food, water, and air is safe for guests and passengers and crew members, making sure that the living quarters are clean, also the public areas are safe, making sure that waste disposal is properly done, and making sure that there are few pests aboard the ship. Next slide. The industry guidelines and standards, as mentioned, are very important, and this can be followed both by the cruise line itself and also the individual cruise ship. They follow corporate policies. You also have the ship's commanders involved, the hotel departments, food and beverage departments, housekeeping, engineering, environmental, and, of course, the medical department, as mentioned. Next slide. Now, shipboard sanitation with respect to food, this is certainly one of the biggest things that people are aware of. One of the things that people take a cruise for is certainly the quality of the food that they find on board the ship. And it's the utmost important for the cruise lines not only to make a great presentation with their food services, but to make sure that it's all palatable and safe. Whenever there's an outbreak of some type of gastrointestinal illness, everyone seems to think that very quickly it may be the food, but as we'll talk about later, the incidence of actual foodborne illness on cruise ships is very low. And this is because they follow HACCP programs very closely. They rely on reliable suppliers. There's strict quality control for the food sources, proper food storage at all time, inventory control, and, of course, food separation so that there's no cross-contamination from the different types of foods. Next slide. It's also made clear that there's sanitary preparation in the serving areas, appropriate cooking and serving temperatures. The cleaning of the utensils is done with a clean, rinse, and sanitize process for all cookware and dinnerware. And there are strict hygiene protocols for food handlers to make sure that they're healthy if they're going to be handling food. Next slide. Water safety is maintained by assuring that there's bunkering of water only from safe sources. Actually, most ships these days are capable of making almost all of their water or more than enough water to supply themselves from seawater through distillation or reverse osmosis. And this is essentially, if they use distillation, it's essentially pure water to the point that it's, you know, it's boiled, it's distilled, and then actually what they have to do is to put in minerals back into it so that it tastes more palatable for people. So the incidence of any type of infections coming from the water source aboard a ship is very low. There's filtering of all the waters that goes into the potable system. There's proper halogenation, and there's continuous monitoring of the water quality. Next slide. Air sanitation, there's filtering of all the air systems aboard ship with air exchange that goes from anywhere from 4 to 6 per hour. There's prompt temperature control and humidity control, and the deck cleaning is done on a regular basis. Next slide. The passenger living quarters, these are areas that are cleaned impeccably at least twice a day. And whenever there's an outbreak or a thought of an outbreak taking place, disinfectants are used not only routinely but with an enhanced process on the bathroom and high hand contact areas. Next slide. Crew living quarters are also cleaned daily. There's very strict crew sanitation regulations for the crew aboard the ships, and there are weekly inspections of all of the crew living quarters. Next slide. The public areas, again, have a daily cleaning with repeated cleaning with each additional use. And again, in the scenario of having a potential outbreak aboard a ship of some type of infectious disease, there's disinfection of heavy hand contact in soiled or contaminated areas. Next slide. Waste management, there's strict adherence to international regulations, there's separation of waste and recycling. Incineration is done on board per proper protocol. The bilge, wastewater, and sewage treatment is done via international guidelines. And their offloading of hazardous materials only to licensed receivers. Next slide. Pests used to be a big problem aboard ships, such as rats, mice, flies, ants, cockroaches, and silverfish. But this is very rare on modern cruise ships due to the strict sanitation protocols in place. There's continuous surveillance for any pests on board the ship. And if something does occur, pesticides are used whenever necessary. Next slide. Now, what I want to do here is shift over and talk about some of the more public type of infectious diseases that the cruise line has had to deal with over the past several years. And certainly at the top of this list has to be norovirus. Unfortunately, it's become known as the cruise ship virus, which is actually a misnomer because the incidence of norovirus aboard cruise ships is only a fraction of what we see shoreside. And I'm sure that in most communities that you all may be from, probably has had some type of norovirus outbreak over the past year or so. It's a bug of many names, originally called NOAC virus or NOAC-like virus, or NLV. It eventually got its own genus just a few years ago in 2002 of norovirus. And it is a small non-envelope virus in at least 4 different genus groups with multiple strains and clusters. Next slide. As mentioned, it's a non-envelope, single-stranded RNA virus. Very infectious. All you need is about 10 to 100 virus particles to become infected. To give you an idea, of how small amount that is. If somebody has vomiting or diarrhea, in each cc of vomitus or diarrhea, you can have 10 to 30 million virus particles out there. So if somebody is vomiting, you can very quickly contaminate the environment with billions of virus particles. And all you really need is 10 to 100 virus particles to become ill. One of the issues with norovirus that we've come to appreciate with outbreaks on board ship is that there can be viral shedding of the virus in the stool for 3 weeks or more. And so even people may become asymptomatic after 1 or 2 days. They have to be very careful to make sure that they're not going to be spreading the virus to the environment or to other people directly. It's a very hardy virus. It can actually survive 0 degrees centigrade, 60 degrees centigrade, in chlorine of 10 parts per billion, 10 parts per million, excuse me. And this is very important when you look at hot tubs, the way that they're halogenated, because typically in most cruise ships and resorts, what they'll use is for halogenation of hot tubs is 4 to 6 parts per million. So if someone has an accident in a hot tub, it can actually survive in a hot tub that usually runs about 100 to 104 degrees Fahrenheit. And one of the other problems with norovirus is that it has limited immunity. Once you get infected, within a few months, you can get infected with the same strain of the virus. And of course, if there are more than one strain of virus that's going around in the community, you can get infected with one and then the other very quickly as well. Next slide. Now, norovirus transmission is by the fecal-oral route. It gets into your mouth in one way or the other. Usually this is from contaminated vomitus or a contaminated surface or directly from person to person by direct contact. Gets into the mouth, goes to the gut and replicates, and then the virus comes out in the stool or in the vomitus. It can be passed via contaminated food, water. It can be aerosolized, and so that people can actually ingest this if there's enough particles in the air. Certainly environmental surfaces is well known to be a fomite in order to receive norovirus. And person-to-person contact via hands is probably the major way that this is spread, particularly on cruise ships. As I had mentioned before, when you have an outbreak of norovirus aboard the ship, most of the guests will think that it's coming from the food, but that is not really the case. The incidence of norovirus transmission via food or water aboard cruise ships is essentially zero. And what typically happens is that a guest will come on board either acutely ill or harboring the virus. They become acutely ill on board the ship, and then they'll have some episodes of vomiting, very often in a public area. And this can, with the vomitus from that guest, it can contaminate an area, 25 feet in diameter or more. And so what happens is that now people will come into the area, sit down or touch a countertop or a telephone or something where the virus has settled down, and they can pick it up on their hands, and then unknowingly they can go ahead and contaminate themselves by putting their fingers in their mouth. And so this is the big problem, and we'll talk about norovirus prevention in a few minutes. Next slide. The CDC in the Mortality and Morbidity Weekly Review back in 2001 looked at the ways that norovirus is felt to be spread in general, not necessarily aboard cruise ships. And they felt that when they looked at these outbreaks within North America, they found that 39% was spread by food, 12% was person-to-person via hand contact, 3% by water. And then, but 46% was unknown, or there was no data available. And this was felt that it was being spread more by aerosolization with the vomitus and environmental surface contamination. As I mentioned already, aboard cruise ships, the way that it's typically spread is by person-to-person contact and environmental surface contamination. Next slide. Now, this slide here deals with the amplification of disease transmission. And when you look at a cruise ship, it's not much different than, say, going to an office building or a mall or a school dorm or a daycare center or a hospital. And what happens if you look at the two red dots on the left, where you may have 1 or 2 people coming on board a ship who may be ill or harboring the virus before they get on board, or it could be any other type of problem, such as influenza as well, which we'll talk about later. They come onto the ship, and then you have close contact with people from different parts of the country and different parts of the world who are going to be susceptible to the particular virus. And so what happens, you'll have a large group of people who will become ill very quickly aboard the ship because the incubation time is 1 to 2 days. And so very often they'll get sick while they're on board the ship. The acute illness will last for 1 or 2 days, so they feel better. But then when they leave the ship, if they're not instructed and educated on how norovirus is spread, that is, they can be spreading it in the stool for 3 or 4 weeks. It can be spread out once they leave the ship and they diverge onto the different communities that they originally came from. Next slide. Now, the norovirus infection, it's often called the stomach flu. In the UK, it's known as LURGY, or winter vomiting disease in different parts of the world. It has an incubation period of 24 to 48 hours. It has anywhere from 12 to 60-hour duration of illness. Usually, people are back to normal, or at least feeling normal, in about 24 hours. And although it's been classified as a mild and short-lived illness, if any of you have been ill with norovirus or have taken care of people with norovirus, particularly during an outbreak situation, you realize that to the persons who are ill, that it's not a very mild illness. Next slide. And what happens with people with norovirus? Well, to develop diarrhea and vomiting, and it can be multiple times. Certainly people can have 5, 10, 15 bouts of diarrhea and vomiting within a matter of several hours. And if they don't have vomiting, they may just have nausea and some abdominal cramps. Some people may also get a headache and muscle aches. A minority of the people develop fever, and this is one of the ways to differentiate, to help to differentiate norovirus and other types of gastrointestinal illness, is that they'll have a lot of diarrhea. At least 50% of the people will have vomiting as well, and very few will have fever. Dehydration is more likely in the young and elderly victims. And what's interesting is that during outbreaks, up to 30% of people may be asymptomatic. And so it's important in an outbreak situation, such as on board a cruise ship, that if you have an outbreak that seems to be brewing, you have to instruct everyone on board, not only those people who are affected, both guests and crew members, but everyone, on how to avoid being infected with norovirus and what they have to do once they become infected and ill. Next slide. Now, norovirus detection, it used to be a very difficult problem. I remember one outbreak that I had aboard a ship about 15 years ago, and at that time they were using electron microscopy to diagnose it. You know, I saw about 100 people in a 24-hour period aboard the ship. We collected stool samples, and it was sent off, and it took several weeks to get the final results back. But these days, the most common way to diagnose it is reverse transcriptase polymerase chain reaction of the stool or vomitus, and you can also do it with special testing with environmental surfaces. This is important because it also allows for sequencing for genotype and cluster ID. And what's interesting is that in the United States and the UK and Europe, there seems to be different strains that are most prevalent in those certain areas of the world and in other parts of the world as well. And so if you have an outbreak on a cruise ship that has a particular strain, say from the UK, the odds are it probably came over with a UK or European guest who came over on board, or a crew member should they come down with the illness as well. The other tests sort of that are available are the ELISA testing, directed immune electron microscopy, and then you can also look at a fourfold increase in acute and convalescent serum titers as well. But the mainstay of testing is the reverse transcriptase polymerase chain reaction. These can be easily done in a matter of hours, and actually some of the ships have the capability of doing some ELISA testing on board as well. Next slide. So the fortunate thing with norovirus is that for the vast majority of the people, it's just symptomatic relief. Once they get ill, they'll be very ill for several hours, perhaps 8, 12, 24 hours, but at the end of that time, they feel better and they're able to go on about their normal activities and their normal eating habits. Once the symptomatic therapies, mainly PO fluids, occasionally we'll provide them with IV fluids as well as antispasmodics for the cramping, analgesics, and antipyretics should they have a mild fever. Next slide. Now, the key point that we see aboard ship, or if you're shoreside in a community that has an outbreak, is try to contain the outbreak itself. And there are three major steps to this. One is the isolated of the infected person. And the reason we do this is that if somebody is having problems with active vomiting and diarrhea, there is a possibility they contaminate public areas aboard the ship or, say, in a hospital or a daycare center. And so what you want to do is try to get them out of the general population until they've stopped having vomiting and diarrhea. This lessens the likelihood that they're going to contaminate the public areas and environmental surfaces. On cruise ships several years ago, what we used to do is isolate these people for 3 days after the period that they were ill, that is the active time of vomiting and diarrhea. And we sort of cut back on this most recently over the past couple of years because we came to realize that even though the people may not be having any more diarrhea, they can still be shedding the virus in the stool. And so it became more important to educate these people on the proper use of hand washing so that they're not going to contaminate the environmental surfaces. And so these days, very often what we'll do is just ask them to remain in their cabins until the time that their vomiting and diarrhea have stopped, and then provide them with information on the proper way to clean their hands, particularly any time that they use the restroom, and to lessen the chances of spreading the virus to other people on board the ship. Environmental disinfection, this is very important because, as we discussed, one of the major routes of transmission of norovirus is by contaminated environmental surfaces. There are a variety of different disinfectants out there that the cruise lines are using, including simple bleach or accelerated hydrogen peroxide and other products. And this is done on a daily basis, on a routine basis. And then when you have the idea that an outbreak may be brewing, they have enhanced processes where they will go around and do environmental disinfection throughout the ship several times a day if necessary to try to decrease the likelihood that the virus is going to be transmitted via the contaminated environmental surfaces. And then, of course, each individual is responsible for making sure that their hands are washed throughout the day. This is very important for the people who have come down with the illness because they can contaminate their hands with vomitus or stool. And if they're not careful on the proper hand-washing techniques, they can go out and spread the virus to an individual directly or to an environmental surface and then have someone come down with the virus indirectly that way. So people are instructed that every time that they use a restroom, they should use running water with lots of soap, wash their hands for at least 20 seconds, and dry their hands with a clean towel or preferably a paper towel so that they can get any contaminants off their hands. Now, a lot of the cruise lines are also using alcohol-based hand sanitizers throughout the ship. And this is stressed that this is just a supplement to proper hand washing because most products out there that utilize different types of alcohols for hand cleansing, they're not very effective against the norovirus itself. And so we always stress to them that they must wash their hands with soap and water, dry the hands thoroughly, and if they want to use the alcohol-based hand sanitizer as a supplement, that is reasonable, but not to depend upon the alcohol sanitizer just as the main method of preventing spread of norovirus. Next slide. Now, the next issue that I want to talk about is that of influenza. And I know influenza in general is on everyone's mind, you know, with the bird flu that's going around the world and the worry about a pan-endemic flu. But I want to talk about the more seasonal variant that we see each year, both in the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere. And because there have been certain seasons within the cruise industry where influenza has become a particularly big issue. And surprisingly that you can see it in various times of the year, not necessarily in the expected flu season. Now, there are two types of flu that can infect humans. One is influenza A, and it's divided into surface antigen-based subtypes based upon the hemagglutinin and the neuraminidase. Then you have influenza B. New variants occur nearly every year due to antigenic drift. And then you have seasonal epidemics. And again, this is very important to remember when you consider that the seasons for influenza in the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere are opposite. So these days, with the ease of international travel, the strict seasonality that we used to see with influenza is really not applicable. To give you an example, back in 1997, I was on call to board a ship to assist them with some medical services, and it was in September, and it was sailing through Boston, out of Boston. And they had several people who had come down with an upper respiratory illness, and six of them had to be disembarked in Montreal. Now, the big worry at that point was that did these people have Legionnaire's disease? And so once they were admitted and they had testing done, it was found out that it was influenza A, which is very strange because our flu season, as you know, in the Northeast probably doesn't get started until perhaps the 1st of December or the end of November. And so what it turned out to be was that there was a group of travelers from Australia who were at the tail end of their flu season down there. And it was a strain that had been brought up by this group of 80 people, and several people had been ill during the trip. And when they boarded the ship, they had a whole group of passengers who were had no immunity against this particular strain, and so several people on board the ship came down with it. And so the important thing to remember when you're talking about influenza involving international travel, the seasonality is not as strict as it used to be. And so you always have to keep that in mind when you're seeing people with influenza-like illness. Next slide. Now, influenza is spread by respiratory droplets, either person to person, and also it's very important to realize, again, that environmental surface contamination can be a major factor in the spread of influenza, particularly during the epidemics that we see every year. Next slide. The infection itself has an incubation period of 1 to 4 days. We've all been through this at one time or another with the fever and the headaches and the myalgia, the general malaise, the sore throat, the rhinitis, the non-productive cough. Younger people and kids may have some nausea and vomiting as well. The duration of the acute illness is typically 3 to 7 days, although people can feel very run down for several days after that. And the infectious period for those people who are ill with the flu can range from anywhere from 1 day prior to and 5 days after the onset of symptoms. Next slide. How do we make the diagnosis of influenza? Well, during an outbreak that you have in your community or larger epidemics, very often it can be done on clinical symptoms itself, particularly with the cough and the rhinitis and the myalgias and the fever. There are several ways we can test for the virus as well. Certainly the one that most people use is the rapid point-of-care diagnostic test. These can be done in 20 or 30 minutes. And they can be testing for both influenza A and B itself. The other types of testing listed above are also used, but these have to do more with hospital settings as well. So I think that most of us these days are more dependent upon rapid diagnostic kits that can be done in any office. Next slide. The treatment is symptomatic for the most part. Rest fluids, acetaminophen, aspirin, or NSAIDs, antihistamines, decongestants, and antitussives. Although when you have epidemics that are going on, a lot of people would be on different medications. Now, the mainstay used to be amantadine and rimantadine for influenza A. However, what we found that this year with the flu season is that neither one of these were very effective for the particular strain of influenza A that we're seeing in the northern hemisphere. So what has become more into vogue lately, particularly with the worry about the bird flu, is the use of oseltamivir or Tamiflu, which is effective for both influenza A and B, and zanamivir or Relenza, which is also very effective for influenza A and B. Now, worldwide, there are different governments that are hoarding, particularly the Tamiflu, for bird flu and for the potential crossover for a pandemic. And only time will tell if this is going to be as effective as people think when they're looking at a worldwide pandemic. Next slide. Influenza prevention, particularly during the outbreak situation, certainly people who are ill, what you want to do is to isolate them for the better part of a week until their coughing and their sneezing is done to try to decrease the spread of the virus itself. You know, people are making plans for the potential pandemic, and they're going to have people who are going to be sequestered who are ill, and then people who are have not been ill as yet, trying to have some way so that these people are going to be separated from those who are ill as well. And there are different communities and governments and worldwide organizations are looking at what has to be done in order to prevent the transmission of influenza should a pandemic occur. Environmental disinfection, this is very important, just like with norovirus. We know that a significant portion of influenza is spread by touching and contaminated surfaces, and then touching a mucosal surface such as your eye, your nose, or your mouth, and this is the major, one of the major transmission routes for influenza. Hand washing, again, this is ultimate. People should be hand washing the hands several times during the day. Anytime that they're involved in using community environmental surfaces, they should wash their hands with soap and water. In this case, this is where the alcohol-based hand sanitizers can be very useful. Influenza is susceptible to this, and the alcohol-based hand sanitizers can be a very useful tool in trying to prevent the spread of influenza. Certainly, flu vaccines are available each year. The efficacy of these can run anywhere from 60 to 90%. One of the big problems is getting people to use it. One of the issues that we run through every year is that when you look at the number of people in the United States who actually get an influenza vaccine only amounts to about 20% of the general population. And even people who are high risk, such as healthcare workers and people with chronic lung disease and heart disease and diabetes, only about 60% of those people are getting the vaccine. So one of the things that governments are trying to stress is the importance of the vaccine in trying to prevent not only becoming ill with influenza, but trying to decrease the spread of it by having more and more hosts out there. And during an outbreak situation, you can also use antiviral medication prophylaxis. Certainly, although amantadine and ranitidine are approved for this, they fall much more out of vogue, and so most people are using mainly oseltamivir or Tamiflu for prophylaxis. Should the people be involved in an outbreak and they haven't had their vaccine as yet? Next slide. Now, the other illness that has cropped up in the cruise industry from time to time is Legionnaire's disease. This is something, as I mentioned, when I was aboard that ship that had the flu outbreak several years ago, the initial worry was that we had a Legionnaire's outbreak in the six people who had to be disembarked from the ship due to respiratory problems. And Legionnaire's disease is caused by Legionella pneumophila, and it's spread by aerosol transmission via contaminated water sources. And this can be whirlpool spas, hot tubs, showers, cooling systems, humidifiers, fountains. And when you have outbreaks in hospitals or extended care facilities, it can also be spread by respiratory therapy equipment. There is no person-to-person transmission. It's only by these water droplets and vapors or mists. It has an incubation period of 2 to 14 days. People come down with fever, chills, cough, headache, myalgias, and certainly the pneumonia is what is most damaging to these people. It can have a duration of illness of anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks or longer, depending upon how severe the pneumonia is, and it has a 10 to 25% mortality rate. They very often have multi-system organ failure, and the mortality rate is directly related to what type of comorbidities the person may have. For instance, people who have COPD, or diabetes, or immunosuppression, these people are going to have more problems with Legionnaire's disease Typically, they will run to increase incidence of respiratory failure. They may require intubation and ventilatory support, but they can also develop renal failure, kidney failure, rhabdomyolysis, and again, multi-system organ failure is the major cause of death in these people. Next slide. Just to mention Pontiac fever, this is also caused by Legionella pneumophila, and it's characterized by fevers, chills, cough, headache, myalgias, but no pneumonia. This is something where the bacteria is not as invasive. The incubation period is 1 to 2 days. It's a shorter duration of illness, and it's usually self-limited. These people get over their illness on their own without any antibiotic treatment. Now, the diagnosis of Legionnaire's disease is something that's very important when you have outbreaks of several people or an unexplained pneumonia in a relatively healthy person where they very quickly become very ill and have very poor respiratory status. And so what you want to do is look at their signs and symptoms with an associated pneumonia. It may start out as a focal pneumonia and become bilaterally very quickly. If you have multiple cases that occur, say, on a cruise ship or in some type of other facility, you have to be very worried that you're dealing with a Legionnaire's outbreak. There are several different ways to test for this. Certainly the one that is used most frequently and the easiest to use is the urinary antigen assay. The other types of testing done is much more complicated, can take several hours or days. And certainly when you're looking at the rise in acute and convalescent serum antibody titers, it's not going to be very helpful initially because that'll take anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks to get that test back. So most of us can do the testing either shore side. There are some tests available that you can do in the office as well for urinary antigen testing. And this is the mainstay of trying to determine whether the person has antigens for Legionella should they have a pneumonia and other symptoms associated with Legionnaire's disease. Next slide. Now, the treatment of Legionnaire's disease is typically with erythromycin, Witterall, rifampin. Other approved antibiotics are azithromycin, levofloxacin, doxycycline. And then, of course, for those people who have severe pneumonia, problems with respiratory failure, they need the respiratory and general support measures. Treatment can be either intravenously or PO, typically for 2 weeks, depending upon the severity of the illness. Next slide. Now, the prevention of Legionnaire's disease is a bit different from the other two diseases that we talked about, norovirus and influenza. What's very important here is that there is proper maintenance of the potential sources that we had talked about. It's also very important that there's proper disinfection of the equipment. In incidents where they found that they've had outbreaks, whether it be aboard ships or shoreside, they found that there was some type of fault in the protocol in getting the equipment cleaned and maintained so that it allowed for standing water to take place or biofilms being formed that would allow for the contamination of misting or vapors that came out of this equipment. It's also important to make sure that the water that is used in these systems is properly halogenated. Some systems, cooling systems, also use ultraviolet light exposure for the reservoirs for the cooling waters. And it's very important that the filters in all these systems, particularly aboard cruise ships and hotels and other facilities that use hot tubs or whirlpool spas, that the filters that they use in these units are properly flushed and replaced on a regular basis. Next slide. Well, we've got a little more time. If people want to have any questions about all of this or any questions about cruise ship medicine or other infectious diseases on cruise ships. And so I'd like to entertain any questions that people may have.
I was wondering if the asymptomatic persons, this is with respect to norovirus infection symptoms, and your bullet, up to 30% may be asymptomatic. Do those asymptomatic persons shed in the same way as the recovered persons who continue to shed for up to 3 weeks?
Well, there are two groups of people here. What's very interesting, and I could really talk about norovirus for several hours, as Paul knows, but there are actually 20% of the general population out there that cannot get infected with norovirus. They're very fortunate that they're lacking a oligopolysaccharide in their gut and they can't absorb it. So there's 20% of the people that are not going to become ill. But of the 30% of the people that may actually get infected without being clinically ill, yes, they can shed the virus. They probably will shed the virus less than the 3 or 4 weeks that we see with people who are acutely ill. And what's interesting is, after a week after the onset of symptoms, about 45% of people are still going to be shedding virus. And at the end of 2 weeks, it's about 35%. And at the end of 3 weeks, it's 25%. So certainly the people who are asymptomatic during an outbreak, again, this raises the importance of instructing everyone on how norovirus is spread and the importance of hand washing to make sure that they don't spread it to anyone else. So, for instance, when there's an outbreak aboard a cruise ship, we're keen to let everybody know aboard the ship, both guests and crew members, that there is an outbreak taking place. And we know that there's a certain percentage that may become infected, who may be minimally symptomatic or asymptomatic. And again, these people will probably not shed as much virus or for as long as those who are acutely ill, but there's that possibility. So that's why it's so important to educate everyone within that facility about the proper preventative techniques for norovirus.
Thank you.
The question that I would ask you is, are you familiar with or have you heard of studies or anecdotal experience with other enteroviruses, such as either Coxsackie or echovirus? Certainly in our company, I know there are isolated cases of people with fairly severe sequelae. I know they're unusual with the enteroviruses, but have you seen this sort of outbreak type of a problem on cruise ships or not?
I think after norovirus, when you're looking at enteroviruses, I think probably the next most common one is going to be rotavirus. It's more common in children. And so if you have certain cruise lines that tend to cater to families with a lot of small children, you may see this coming up about as well. And certainly you're going to see the worst symptoms and sequelae associated with the infants, the young children, and the elderly that are infected in all this as well. So certainly whenever you have outbreaks, you're always worried about that you're going to have a particular group of people. Again, the younger and the older are people with comorbid problems. These people are probably going to be more susceptible to having serious problems associated with these illnesses.
How many doctors and nurses typically travel on a cruise ship, and how are they trained? Where do they come from?
Well, this is a very interesting issue. First of all, I've sailed on ships where I was the only medical person on board the ship, but that would be typically less than 100 passengers aboard the ship, or perhaps 150 passengers aboard the ship, and then it goes up from there, depending upon the total number of people that are sailing on board a ship. For instance, the Freedom of the Seas, which is the new ship that came out from Royal Caribbean, with approximately 4,000 guests and 1,500 crew members or more. They've got two doctors and I think five or six nurses on board the ships as well. And so it varies upon the size of the ship and the number of people that you're caring for. Now, the cruise industry is an international industry, as you all know. And so the crew members, including the medical staff, come from all parts of the world, Canada, North America, South America, Central America, certainly Europe, and all over the world. It has to do with very often where the ship is registered or flagged, and they have their own requirements over where they can get their medical staff from. For instance, a lot of the British ships, you have to have a British license or be a British citizen in order to work on there as one of the medical staff. And so it varies from cruise line to cruise line. And I think that at this point in time, it's about 25% or so of the doctors and nurses out there are probably coming from North America, and the rest make up the rest of the international medical staff.
Could I put that question to Dr. Hill as well? Where does Holland America get their physicians from?
At this point, virtually 100% of our nurses and doctors come from North America, either Canada or the United States. We have on occasion utilized UK personnel, and we may do more of that in the future. But I would say also addressing a question regarding the training and the experience. We really require people who have had 3 years post-medical school training. Most of our docs are board certified in one of the primary care specialties, and the vast majority are within emergency medicine. I would say that the training of the long-term staff, we have crew physicians and lead medical officers who are typically nurses, have a fair amount of knowledge and experience in the subjects that we've discussed today. And in fact, surveillance is pretty much standard within the industry now, both daily for both the GI and respiratory illnesses. And it's one of the reasons why the government, especially the CDC and the various public health authorities, are very interested in following and watching what is happening within the industry, because they're often a bellwether for what's going to be happening in our own home settings.
Oh, just one other comment. Both Dr. Hill and I have been involved in emergency medicine for 25 years or so, and the American College of Emergency Physician has a section of cruise ship and maritime medicine that we were charter members of back in 1990. And this is a group of about 300 physicians now, mainly from North America, but also from other parts of the world, that are involved in cruise ship medicine. And what we've been able to do in working with the cruise industry is to develop guidelines for cruise ship medical facilities to try to enhance the capabilities of the medical facilities on board the ships, and to enhance the qualifications of the doctors and nurses that are sailing out there, taking care of both the guests and the crew members.
You often hear of cruise ships that have been have had an outbreak, and then the very next time they sail, they have another outbreak. After a hell cruise, what do cruise ships do to prevent reinfections the next time that the ship sails?
Well, this goes to environmental disinfection. You know, as you know, the virus itself, when you're talking about norovirus, we know that it can probably, during an outbreak, stay on a surface somewhere for a couple of weeks. And so if the disinfection services aren't complete, or if somebody is still on board that can recontaminate a clean surface, then this is how these are spread from one cruise to the next. And because what will happen is that if you have an outbreak take place on one particular cruise and you have a lot of people who are ill, and the cruise lines will start their enhanced disinfection processes as soon as they feel that there's an outbreak going on. And we're talking about having cleaners going around and cleaning surfaces, you know, every 3 or 4 hours. When on certain outbreaks, what they will do, they'll also go around to the public restrooms and clean them on an hourly basis. Or what they'll even do is close down the public restrooms, because, you know, on a cruise ship, everybody has their own restroom in their cabin. And so by using their own cabin restroom, there's less likelihood that they're going to contaminate restroom for someone else, or get infected when they go into a restroom that has had some vomiting in there. And so what they try to do is, with their enhanced disinfection processes, go throughout the ship, you know, stem to stern, top to bottom, to get this all cleared out. But what will happen is that typically, as a new group of passengers come on board, you have a new group of potential hosts there as well, and these people can pick this up, and it doesn't take much to pick up, you know, 10 to 100 virus particles from a surface that may not have been totally disinfected. And so what will happen, though, is typically it may linger on for a few days or a week. Occasionally you'll have this coming on board sequential cruises, more than two. But what's interesting is what they found in some of these incidences, they found that there were different strains coming on. And so the first outbreak was caused by a particular strain that was brought on board, and they had cleaned that all up. And then what actually happened was that someone else came on board with another strain, totally unrelated to the first, and so they actually had a whole new outbreak taking place. So it's just due diligence in trying to make sure that all environmental surfaces are cleaned, and making sure that the guests and the crew members are aware that there has been or is an outbreak going on, and instructing them on proper hand hygiene as well.
Hi, this is Carter Hill. I wanted to actually give a kind of support and addendum to that. I just returned from 4 months at sea on doing the physician position on a world cruise. And one of the things that we do and have done in a situation like this is not just being much more militant about quarantining or isolating those people who are sick, doing, I think, even a better job in informing the guests about the risks, isolating crew members who are symptomatic. For example, in the Lido lines, there's a person there who literally is insisting that every single person coming through does the hand wash or the cleaning solution on the hands. We have staff who are, in fact, serving all of the passengers. The passengers are not touching the serving utensils. So that the exposure and contact to the fomites is minimized where it can be possibly done. This is not something that the cruise lines take lightly because the cost ranges anywhere from $15,000 to $30,000 a day to enhance these cleaning type procedures. And so but we know that it works, and this is how we can generally prevent the secondary and third cruise sequentially having a similar infection. So in summary, as a host, I'd like to thank Dr. Wheeler and Paul Weber for organizing the infection control on cruise ships. I'd like to thank Johnson Diversey for sponsoring this. And again, I want you to all think seriously about what you've learned from this and going back to the obvious things that we know work. Hand washing does work. If you carry nothing away, advise nothing else differently, hand washing will make a difference. So thank you very much.